Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Gimel with Aleph, four lines down. Tanya, we have a braita. Haya, Rabbi Meir Omer, Adam over Avera b'seter. Person violates an Avera in private. Va'kodesh Baruch Hu machriz alav bigalui. And Hashem makes it into a public issue. Shinemar, va'var alav ruach kina, that comes upon him, this ruach of kina, which we've discussed until now what the word kina means. But there means a ruach of kina to do me matre, to warn, or a kas, that of anger, that causes friction in the relationship. Ve'in avera elishon hachraza. So what does it mean, va'avara lav, that it came upon him, this spirit of kina? So the word avera, we would normally say that's what came upon the individual. In ve'in avera elishon hachraza. Avera does not mean that it happened or it came upon him, but rather it's announced. Shenemar, Vayitzav Moshe, Vayaviru Kol B'machane. Moshe makes the announcement, and they then spread the word throughout the machane, that they have enough donations for the Mishkan. And so Vayaviru here has the meaning of to make public or to make known. And so to over here, Varvara Lav Ruach Kina, is also something to be made known, as Rashi says over here. Shenotein b'leva bala lahaknot la. Shem causes hit the heart of her husband to press this button. V'davar mitpersem b'galui. And that causes it to be exposed. Hashem plants the seed in the husband's heart to do this kina, which will result in the fact that this woman's misdeeds will be publicized. This is something that we noted yesterday, that the uniqueness of seeing the sota is this high concept of exposure of that which is in the hidden. And it's something that should speak deeply and emotionally to individuals, that even though we sin in private or we think no one is seeing, in the end all of this is exposed. And the sota is the quintessential private sin that then becomes fully exposed to the public at large. And so that's why Aurea Sota B'Kukula is so impactful. But over here also, conceptually, the idea that every Avera in the end will be known because it becomes part and parcel of who we are as individuals. Kerish Lekesh Amar, En Adam Over Avera, Elaim Kein Ichnas Bo Ruach Shtut. A person doesn't violate a sin unless he has a certain amount of shtut, unbridled passion, emotion, or the classic definition of the word shtut is that someone who's not of sound mind who does such a thing. Shenemar, ish, ish, ki, tiste, ishto. So over here, the word stia is someone who deviates from the norm. That's ki, tiste, ishto. But if you read it without the nikudot, you could read it as tiste, that it happened because of a shtut, because she lost her mind, and that's why it happens. So tishtek tiv, which is indicative of the nature by which a person commits a sin. If you think about the Rambam's formulation of why we say that when an individual doesn't do a mitzvah taseh, that we're gofin oto achimur rotza ani, we beat him until he says, yeah, I want to do it, and then we say that he's doing it willingly. So Rambam says, what type of willingness is this? If you force him to act in this manner by giving him corporal punishment, the answer he gives is that's because deep down, everybody wants to do the right thing, and people want to follow the Torah and the mitzvot Hashem. So when you hit him, you just align himself with his true essence. If you look at it in that manner, then the ruach shtut over here is the ability of a person to put a wedge between their true essence and the way that they act. How do they do that? There has to be something that separates between what they know intellectually and how they act emotionally. And so that even though they know something to be true, or deep down, that's what they really want to do, nevertheless, there's some overwhelming passion, emotion, or desires that drive the person to do something that they otherwise wouldn't do. And that could be from the fact that it's an emotion overriding, or emotion or passion overriding what they intellectually know, or whether it's the ability of the individual to subvert that which they know to be true, or what their true essence is in order to perform the avera. And that's true in general, like Rabbi Yochanan's statement in the Gemara in Brachot, when his students ask him, you know, for advice or a bracha before he dies, he says that your fear of heaven should be like your fear of people. And he said, that's it? And he says, halavai, that you should be as afraid of Hashem than you are as afraid of people. Because he says, people say, I hope no one sees me when they're doing an avera, but they don't worry about the fact that Hashem is watching them the whole time. The fact that one could ignore the Ashkacha Hashem, or ignore the fact that Shavita Hashem, the Negdi Tamid, Hashem is always there and watching, and perform the avera, requires a certain amount of shtut, requires a certain amount of subverting of what a person knows to be true, or is aware of, in order to perform the avera. And that's what it means here, that a ruach shtut is what allows the individual to sin. Tana debei Rabbi Shmuel, Ipnei ma hemina Torah ed echad besota. Why does the Torah believe in ed echad by sota? Shiraglayim ledavar. Because you have, as we said yesterday, circumstantial evidence that would lead you to believe that there's something wrong here. Sharei kinala venistera ve'ed echad miida shehitmeya. So you have here a process by which this woman is no longer this innocent woman who the husband is angry about, is jealous of, or is mistreating in a way, but she's really acted in a manner that arouses suspicion about her motives and behavior. Her husband asks her not to seclude with such an individual. She ignores that, secludes with the individual, which is an avera in and of itself, yichud. But besides that, in the context of the fact that her husband already suspects that there's something going on and told her not to isolate or seclude with this individual, she does that. And then we have an Eid Echad coming along and telling us that something went wrong here. So then that Eid Echad is going to carry a lot more weight because of the circumstantial evidence that surrounds the situation. And therefore there's a special dispensation given here where normally you'd need two Eidim for any testimony. Over here, one Eid will suffice because of the context in which this is transpiring. In this instance, all the one Eid can do is, number one, to seal her fate that she is now asur to her husband. She was asur to her husband anyway, but now she can't go drink the mesota and be cleared. The Eid Echad now forces it where she must get divorced. So she'll be asur to her husband, asur to the Boel, and she'll lose her ktubah. That's the power of this Eid Echad. So for a capital punishment, you will need a second Eid. You will need all of the normal procedures that accompany a capital case. The Eid Echad only here seals the fate of this woman to have to separate from her husband and makes it there will be no reconciliation here or no possibility of Shalom Bayit. Amalei Rav Papa Labaye, V'ha kiktiva kinui batar stira v'tumahu dikhtiva. But he says there's a little problem here, which is that in the order of the psukim by the sota, at first it talks about the fact that she secluded with this individual, then she did something wrong with this individual, and then only then does it talk about the fact that her husband is upset, jealous enough, angry enough, or wants to rectify this situation, that he warns her at that point in time. But that's out of order, and we're suggesting over here that the order of the psukim is kinui, stira, and then tuma, but that's not supported by the way that it is written in the parsha, because in the parsha it says, ish ish kitiste ishto umalo bomal, v'shechav ish ota shechvat zera, so that there was stira and tuma, then only then does the kinui show up. Well, the kinui is showing up a little too late. We are suggesting here that the kinui is the starting of the process. The husband's kinui is what generates the circumstances in which the Eid Echad is believed, or generates the stira that will then make it problematic and force the woman to drink. But in the psukim, it doesn't sound like that. It sounds like the kinui comes after the fact. So first of all, you're arguing here that it's raglaim ledavar. The kinui here happens afterwards. And number two is, then that can't be the premise by which all of this transpires, is because there's kinui first. So then he answers him, amalei vavar vikvar avar. When it says vavar alav ruach kina, it means literally, va'avar, in the past, or that it happened previous to this. The word va'avar doesn't always mean that it came upon him at that time, or he had that feeling, but va'avar can mean that it did happen already. He already had warned her of this issue. And that's what it means, Vavar la ruach kinah, that already there was a warning, and that precedes the, what really is before this in the psukim of the nistara vihi nitma'a. Elamiata. So if that's the way that you interpret the word vavar, what are you going to do with the pasuk in the end of Bamidbar, which is vavar lachem kol chalutz? Where Moshe is speaking to Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe, who are taking their inheritance, Be'ever Yardain, and there he instructs them, Vavar lachem kol chalutz, and you will be the front lines, the pioneers, you'll be the ones who go in the conquest first. And Moshe there is clearly talking about the future, and saying, Vavar lachem kol chalutz. Then in the future, they will go in front. So the word avar doesn't mean it already happened, but rather avar is indicative of something in the future. So hachanami. So to over here, you should say the same thing. Over there, the context of the pasuk tells you, the remainder of the context there tells you that Hashem will go before you to conquer the land, and then only then will you come back to settle in the lands that you choose as your inheritance. So that's indicative of the fact that this is all being said in the future, and therefore the Vavar lachem kol chalutz contextually must mean in the future. Elohocha, but over here, Isak adatcha kiktivi, if you think that the order is the way that it is written, then what are you going to say? V'nistara v'hitme'a ve'avar batar tumah v'stira kinui lomali. If the act has already been perpetrated, then what does the kinui do at this point in time? It's meaningless. So the kinui after the fact will have no bearing or have no value. So therefore, contextually, it only makes sense to say v'avar lav ruach kina, which is something that already happened, that the kinui preceded the nistara v'nit me'a. Tanno debei Rabbi Shmuel. Ein adam mekaneh l'ishto, elim ke nichnasa bo ruach. That a person is not mekaneh his wife, unless some sort of spirit descends upon him. Again, it's similar to the statement that we had before by Rabbi Meir, the idea that the ruach kinah came from Hashem in order to expose this woman. So too here, this ruach is what generates the warning of the husband. Shinemar, v'avar alav, ruach kinah, v'kineh tishto. It's not simply v'kineh tishto, but first what happens is, v'avar alav ruach kinah, that he is overcome or enveloped by this ruach kinah, and this ruach kinah is what generates the kineh tishto. So again, even if you interpret over here the word kinah to mean jealousy, v'kinei et ishto, in an active form, in the verb form, what does that mean, v'kinei et ishto? So the jealousy causes the individual to act. When someone is jealous and acts, what is the act that comes about from that jealousy, v'kinei et ishto? So either it can be a warning, or v'kinei et ishto, it could be a release of the pent-up anger or disappointment that the individual has, or the kinei show is that it generates friction between the parties. Because this person is jealous, therefore he acts in a certain manner that either demonstrates his anger about the situation or causes the other person to be angry because of the jealousy or the way that the person is acting. So even again, if you take the pashtut of the word kinah to mean jealousy, even in that context, once you turn it into an active form, an active verb, it must mean something, and that's what we discussed before, whether it meant to warn, to cause friction, cause anger, or like we said, the word kanai, someone who is acting on behalf of Hashem, that's because they're jealous of anybody crossing Hashem. And so that causes them to be a kanai, to act on it, and to act out on that, to release that anger, or to warn that individual through their behavior, warn other individuals through their behavior, that this is not a way to act. So then, my ruach, what exactly is this spirit that descends upon him? Rabbanan amre, ruach tuma. So the Rashi over here says, Rabbanan here, the Rabbanan debay Ravashi. The Beit Midrash of Ravashi said it was a ruach tuma. Ravashi amar, ruach tahara. So the Rabbanan say that it is this unclean, impure spirit, whereas Ravashi himself says it is a spirit of purity. Now, the ruach tuma might relate to the fact that we said in yesterday's daf, every man gets the woman he deserves. And therefore, the behavior of the woman might be reflective of the husband's behavior as well. So the fact that there's a ruach tumah over here might be that it's the husband's tumah that's causing or precipitating the problem here. And so the woman's behavior is a reflection of the tumah of the husband, and that's what causes him to act out or to speak up in this instance, because in a sense, it's his own behavior that is being reflected. It's a mirror of himself. Or it's a ruach tahara, which Rashi interprets over here is that this person has a certain aversion to a lack of tzniut or to pritzut that causes him to act in this case. There is this subconscious uneasiness with this type of behavior or inability to live in the context of such behavior that causes him to act out. So it'll be ruach tahara, ruach tumah. The other possibility is the motives behind his kinah. He could be motivated because there is something wrong and that there is definitely a reason for him to act out, or he can be motivated by ulterior motives where the woman is really innocent, but the husband is pressing buttons or doing things that are inappropriate and she's innocent. And so that also, in a more generic sense, could be ruach tumah, ruach tahara, is what is the motivation for the kinah that is being generated here by the husband. So, mistavra keman damar ruach tahara, the Gemara says it makes more sense like Rav Ashi. D'tanya, v'kinei et ishto, rishut, divrei Rabbi Yishmael. So now we're back to this machloket that we ended with on yesterday's daf, which is that, v'kinei et ishto, according to Rabbi Yishmael, rishut, is optional. Rabbi Kiva omer, chova. Rabbi Kiva says that it's obligatory, that he must do it. Iyamar bishlama ruach tahara, if you say that the impetus for the kinah here is a ruach tahara, shapir. Then it makes sense that they're arguing about whether it's a chova or it's a reshut. Is it an obligation or is it optional? Eliyamar, it's ruach tumah, reshut, v'chova, le'ulei inshe ruach tumah b'nafshe. Since when would it be even a discussion about whether it's optional or whether it's obligatory to have a ruach tumah? Ruach tumah is obviously something negative. And so why would we be talking about obligations to have that negative feeling? Or a option to have this negative feeling. We don't want a ruach tumah, period. So it makes more sense to indicate here that it's a ruach tahara, which is something more positive, and that the ruach tahara over here is coming from a good place, or is a good thing. And therefore, you can argue about whether the person is obligated to act on it, or obligated to create this kina, or is it optional? It's up to him to do this. Obviously, the husband can't hide his head in the sand and ignore the fact that his wife is acting inappropriately. Then he's held culpable as well in that case. The question here is whether there's questionable behavior or there's suspicions of something going on. How obligated is the husband to act in this case? Now, it might relate to what the purpose of the Parshia of Sota is. So despite the fact that we've been discussing now about kina, friction, kas, and warnings that go on, the Parsha of Sota is described, as we'll see in the Masechta and in the Midrashei Chazal, as being something that is to generate shalom ben ish li ishto, to create peace between a husband and a wife. That a husband has a right in these situations to divorce his wife. The truth is that even according to the Machmirim in Masechet Gittim, that only allowed a get for inappropriate behavior, but inappropriate behavior that revolves around arayot, or some sort of sins that are in the marital relationship, then this would be grounds for divorce over here. Even Beit Shammai would agree that this is a grounds for divorce, yet the Torah offers the opportunity to this individual to reconcile with his wife and to bring shalom ben ish li ishto. So this is an alternative, as long as nothing really transpired. This is an alternative to have the husband and wife reconcile. And again, we're not talking about a situation in which there's no circumstantial evidence. There's no reason to believe that something's wrong. There's behavior here that was completely inappropriate by the wife. Nevertheless, the husband who wants to stay together with his wife, the Torah gives him a vehicle or an opportunity to do that. And so now the question is it a chovah? Is he obligated to take up that opportunity to reconcile? Or is it a reshut? He can then choose to divorce her, or he can use this vehicle, meaning that he has the right to choose. How obligated is he, basically, to try to reconcile versus terminating the marriage? Tosafot over here raises something that we mentioned yesterday, which is the Yushami, who connects between this machlok between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva, and the machlok that we saw yesterday between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua. That machlok yesterday between Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Eliezer is connected to a machlok between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, and then connects into this machlok here as well, which is that Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva here arguing whether it's a chuvah or a reshut. That chuvah reshut might relate to the fact that what's the rights that you have to divorce. So Rabbi Eliezer, who's a Talmid of Beit Shammai, Beit Shammai believes that you're only allowed to divorce for reasons of erva. Therefore, he will believe that it's a chuvah, it's obligatory to do the kina over here, because you can't get divorced unless you can show that there's some sort of problem of arayot. On the other hand, for Rabbi Yoshua, he's a Talmid of Beit Hillel, who says you can divorce for any reason you want. If you just don't like her, you can get divorced. Then over here, it's going to be a reshut. It's optional whether you do the kina in this instance. And that will also relate to their machloket about kinui and stira, as to what the requirements of kinui and stira with regards to how many edim you need in the instances of kinui and stira. So now, if you connect it to the divorce, then it's kimatsa ba irvat davar, which is the terminology that's used by a divorce. And then their machloket in the Yerushalmi is about how you interpret matzah ba davar. Mitziah means two edim. Davar, what is the davar that we're speaking about here? Are we speaking about a davar erva? Or we're speaking about a davar, which is a dibur? And that will determine where you need two edim, whether you need it by the kinoi, or you also need it by the stira as well. So that is the way that Yerushalmi explains it. And we noted that yesterday. Tosafot over here says that he doesn't think it makes so much sense. Because in that Mishnah in Gittin, where the Machloket Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai takes place, there's actually a third opinion over there, and it's Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva is the most makil in that Mishnah, in that Machloket between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Rabbi Akiva is makil the Gamre. And here, Rabbi Akiva is of the opinion that it's a chovah. So according to the Yerushalmi, there should be a correlation between the easiness or the ease by which you can get a divorce to the fact that kina should be then a reshut or optional. The more strict you are about the way that you can get a divorce, the more likely you are to say chovah. Yet Rabbi Kiva here says it's a chovah, and he's the makil by the ease of getting a divorce. So Tosafot, based on that, says that he thinks, number one, that explanation is very difficult within the shita of Rabbi Akiva. And then he says something very interesting in the end, and he says, V'teima l'fior Yerushalmi. According to the Yerushalmi, Kevin detalya kinui begerushin, since kinui is tied to divorce, havalei mitne sota bater gitin. Sota should have come after gitin, not the way that we have it, which is, sota is before gitin, it's reversed. Ubatar sota nazir kederach parshiot. Ubatar nazir nidarim. And then after nazir nidarim, batar nidarim ktubot. And then the opposite way around, the way that the should be situated. It's interesting only because the Rambam does have that. The Rambam has Sota coming after Gittim in his Seder of the Masechtot. So he does follow this, in a sense, this Yerushalmi, that there's a connection between Gerushin and Kinui, and therefore Sota follows Gittin according to the Rambam. So that the Tosafot looks at it as a question or a difficulty, whereas the Rambam actually thinks that that might be the case, that Sota comes after Gittin. So now the Gemara goes to the Machloket Gufa. V'kinei et ishto reshut divi Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Kiva omer, chova. The Gemara wants to understand their positions. So the Machloket here, as the Gemara notes, is not unique to the case of Sota, but rather it is a broader Machloket that they have in a number of instances. La'itama, when it comes to a Kohen who is restricted from becoming Tamei to Matameit, he has dispensations for certain relatives. One of those is his unmarried sister, La'itama. So there the Torah says he will become Tamei for her. Reshut, Divi Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Shmuel says he has the option to become Tamei for her. Rabbi Kiva Omer, Chuba. Rabbi Kiva says, no, it's an obligation that he becomes Tamei. Lo'olam Bahem Tavodu. It says that you will always subjugate them. Here it's referring to the Knanim, the Evid Knani. So Reshut, Divi Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Shmuel says that if you so choose to subjugate them, then you may do so. Rabbi Akiva Omer, chuba. No, it's an obligation. Lo'olam behem tavod. You must subjugate them, and to free them is problematic. We discussed this in another context, that the freeing of Neved Kanani is a violation, possibly, according to Rabbi Akiva, of lo'olam behem tavodu, and therefore you need, depending on the gears of the Gemara, either mitzvah or mitzvah derabim shiny. That only when there are special circumstances would you be permitted then to free an Eved Kanani. Gemara talks about in the context of the necessity for a minion, or they needed the Eved Kanani for whatever reason, but there was an impetus beyond just simply freeing the Eved Kanani, because it says, Olam Behem Tavodu, which is a chuva according to Rabbi Akiva. So here we have three machlokot between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael, where Rabbi Yishmael says that the Torah's instruction is an optional, whereas Rabbi Akiva says that the Torah's instruction is obligatory, that you must do it in these cases. What's interesting here, the top Tosafot discusses here, he says, wait a minute, but now we have a problem, because doesn't the Gemara tell us in Masechet Makot that there are Tayag mitzvot, there are 613 mitzvot, and now what are you going to do? Either Rabbi Akiva has too many mitzvot, or Rabbi Yishmael has too few mitzvot, because they can't get to the 613, they're arguing over here. Now, Tosafot's question is not such a strong question, because the answer is, or what's obvious to us, is that Rabbi Akiva, who says there are mitzvot here, will have to say in other cases that Rabbi Yishmael believes there's a mitzvah, Rabbi Akiva will have to say that it is a reshut, or it's not a mitzvah, it's only a mitzvah derabanan. They'll argue about the content of the 613 mitzvot, which is interesting in itself because, first of all, there's a machloket tanaim. It's not obvious that there's 613 mitzvot. That's not even a number that's necessarily muskam. It's a number that the Gemara puts forward, but there are other tanaim who have different opinions about it. And even if you say there's 613 mitzvot, the Gemara never enumerates the 613 mitzvot, which leads us to the machlokot that come up in terms of the minyana mitzvot or the moneha mitzvot that argue about what are the 613 mitzvot. Although Tosafot in a Havamin at least suggests that everybody would have the same count of 613. What Tosafot says in the end is that's just not the case. Some places where Rabbi Yishmael will say it's a mitzvah min haTorah, Rabbi Akiva will call it an asmachta ba'alma. He'll say those psukim are just an asmachta and it's really a din derabanan. One thing that you can take away from the Bali HaTosafot is something that the Rambam says in his introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvot, where he criticizes those that previously counted the mitzvot, which is that Dinei Drabanan cannot be one of the 613 mitzvot. The Rambam makes that clear, because in the counting of the Rasag, he includes certain mitzvot Drabanan. So the Rambam says unequivocally that there can't be mitzvot Drabanan that are counted in the 613 mitzvot, and Tosafot here says that the way that Rabbi Akiva will get out of the problem is he'll say certain mitzvot are only in Asmak, only in Dinei Drabanan. So Tosafot agrees with that view, that you cannot have mitzvot derabanan counted in those tayag, in those 613 mitzvot. So now, the Tosafot over here also asked, and it's a very important question, which is, what does it matter whether it's reshut or chuvah over here? Let us look at the circumstances. If you look at the circumstances, if there's nobody else to bury his sister, then he is obligated both according to Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva, because there's a din of make mitzvah that he has to become tamei. It would be obligatory according to Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva, because you have a make mitzvah here. If there are other people being metapulim with the mate, then what does it mean that he's obligated to become Tamei? He can choose to become Tamei, he can help them out, or he cannot become Tamei. Then it should be a Reshut according to both of them. So then, what's the meaning here of Reshut and Chuvah? So Tosafot over here says, La'itama mitzvah, v'nafkamina be'osek b'mitzvah. So nafkamina for osek b'mitzvah, poter mina mitzvah. So the difference here between Chuvah and Reshut. If it's an obligation, then he's engaging in this quote-unquote mitzvah, will exempt him from other mitzvot. On the other hand, if it's a reshut, then it will not exempt him from other mitzvot because it's a choice that he makes. Now that's important. This relates to a Tosafot that's found in Masechet Brachot. Tosafot over there argues on Rashi when the Gemara says, Tfilat Arvit reshut or is Tfilat Arvit chova? Is the davening of Mariv an obligation or is it optional? So the way the Rashi learns it, literally, is an obligation you must daven Mariv? Or is it a reshut, which means you don't have to daven Mariv? Reshut there doesn't mean optional, but means that you don't have to. There's no need to daven Mariv. The other hand, Tosafot says that that's not the meaning of the word reshut. The word reshut doesn't mean if you so choose. Reshut means you do it unless there's another factor or another mitigating circumstance. which means that it is a mitzvah to do it. It's just not strong enough to override other considerations. And that's exactly what Tosafot says over here. He's consistent with his opinion about what the word reshut means. He says that the nafkamina in this case is a sick mitzvah, but termina mitzvah. That means that reshut means you do it unless you have something else to do. I mean, there's another mitzvah, there's something else that would mitigate your ability to do this or your necessity to do this. But otherwise, you should be doing it. And that's how he interprets the word reshut here as well. Do it unless there's something else you must do. Chovah would say you do it even if there's something else to do. And that's the same way that Tosafot defines chovah and reshut in Masechet Brachot with regards to Ma'ariv. It's how he describes it over here as chovah and reshut in this circumstance. But interesting about this is that the Rambam paskins like Rabbi Akiva and says that a kohen who one of the seven relatives passed away, that he should become tamei to take care of them. And if he doesn't become tamei, mitamim oto. We force him to become tamei. We are actually mitamei him. And he says, anybody who doesn't become tamei for those relatives, eino ela achzari. That is a person that is insensitive, callous to the human condition, and in a sense doesn't belong as a kohen. If the kohen has this mistaken impression that he is a kohen, he is kadosh, he is tahor, and therefore he shouldn't become tamei because that's beneath him. That's not something that he stoops to do. The Rambam says that type of mistaken impressions about what a kohen is achzariyut. It's a person who no longer understands what it means to be a human being. He's lost any sense of just being a person. And that being a kohen can no longer represent Hashem or even represent the people to Hashem. That the kohen in that instance has to feel the emotion of the loss. And in feeling the emotion of loss, he becomes tamei. If he doesn't come tamei, we admit tameim to show him how you're supposed to behave in these situations. That you have to be a human being. And being a human being is one of the prerequisites for being an Oved Hashem and for also representing B'nai Yisrael and Hashem in the world. There's only one person who has that standing, and that's the Kohen Gadol. It's the only person with that standing. But regular Kohenim do not have that standing. And it's a key element of difference between Yadut and many other religions that the leadership has to be human beings. They have to get married, they have to have kids, they have to be a part of society because they have to understand what the plight of a human being is and what the plight of individuals who are making ends meet, what it means to be a person. And therefore, they can only be leaders when they understand what everybody else is going through and when they're a part and parcel of society at large. So now, we have here three machlokot between them with regards to chuvah and reshut. And then, Amalei Rav Papa Abaye, Rav Papa says to his Rebbe Abaye, V'amri lo, Rav Misharshi al Rava, there was a Misharshi al Rava, Leima, Rav Yishon, Rav Yekiva, Chol HaTorah Kula, Hochi Pligit. Let us say that this is a machloket that persists throughout the Torah. Demar Amar Reshut, that any time there is a positive commandment in the Torah, Rabbi Shmuel says it's a Reshut, Umar Amar Chuvah, and Rav Yekiva says it's a Chuvah. The way that Rashi interprets it is that it's literally, to take this literally, that any positive commandment in the Torah, Rabbi Shmuel would say is optional, not obligatory. The Baalei Tosafot are a little queasy about saying something like that, and they seem to indicate here that it doesn't mean in any instance, but rather, where there's a reason to believe that it will be a reshut, in all those cases, Rabbi Shmuel will believe it's a reshut. It's not particular to these three cases, but in any case, where there's a reason to believe that it shouldn't be obligatory, then Rabbi Shmuel will say that it's a reshut. So Amar Lei, Rabbi says back to Rav Papa or Rav to Rav Misharshia, Hocha Bikrai Plige. That here they argue in the Sukkim. It says, V'kineit Yishto Reshut, Divi Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Kiva Omer Chova. My time with the Rabbi Shmuel. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Shmuel's position? Sover lo ki hai tano. He holds like this tana, the Tanya, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Omer, Kapleisha Amar Torah lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha, says you may not harbor hatred of your fellow Jew in your heart. Yocho kagonzo. You would think that it's applicable in this case. Meaning that the husband here cannot be upset or harbor ill will towards his wife in this case. Tamalomar, varvar lav ruach kina, v'kinei et ishto. The Torah gives you permission in this instance to act on that anger, to speak out about what is bothering you. Rabbi Akiva, kinui achrina aktiv. Rabbi Akiva says that there's actually a another kinah that's mentioned in the pasuk. So what you have here is a machloket about what the Torah is saying when it says v'kinei et ishto. Rabbi Shmuel says it's a dispensation because you have a restriction of lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha, and in v'kinei et ishto you'll be in violation of lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha. The Torah gives you a dispensation in this case that you're allowed to be sonet him in this instance. The Torah does a similar thing with a person who is in a over aveira. Over there, the Torah says you're allowed to hate. It's not necessarily the person, but the acts that he takes or that behavior you're allowed to. And the Torah there gives you permission to have sinah in certain instances. So this will be another one of those instances where the Torah gives you a dispensation. Bikiva says that the pasuk says kinah twice. One to give you the dispensation. The second one to tell you that it's obligatory. And that's because the pasuk says, "Varvar lav ruach kinah, v'kinei et ishto v'hit nitma'ah." And he will then warn his wife or act on that jealousy. And v'hinitma'ah, it's true. Oh, avar alav ruach kinah v'kinei et ishto v'hi lo nitma'ah. So again, it says kinei et ishto twice. One when he's right, one when he's wrong. But it says it twice. So Rabbi Kiva says the first one is the dispensation. The second one is the obligation. That's Rabbi Kiva believes that it's a chovah. On the other hand, Rabbi Shmuel, I did divide in michta v'hi nitma'ah. Because the pasuk says has to write v'hi nitma'a, v'hi lo nitma'a, k'tiv nami v'kinei et ishto. It repeats the entirety of the phrase, even though it wasn't necessary. The only thing it needed to do was say, v'avar lav ruach kinah v'kinei et ishto, v'hi nitma'a, o, v'hi lo nitma'a. That's what it could have done. Instead, it says, o, and it repeats the whole phrase. Look at Adana Debri Rabbi Shmuel, which is the principle of Rabbi Shmuel. The Tana Rabbi Shmuel, kol parsha shenema v'nishneit, any parsha that's written in the Torah and then duplicated, lo nishneit elo bishvil davar shenitchadesh ba, that it's only written for the unique difference between those different things. So you can have an entire repetition, which is exactly the same, in a sense, unnecessary, but it's done to highlight the one difference or the contrast between them. So over here, it's between hi nitma and hi lo nitma, so there's a difference. So the Torah will expend words or letters in order to express it in a longer form, even though the only additional item is v'hi lo nitma. So to repeat v'kinei et ishto, and because of that, you can't give significance to the second v'kinei et ishto, because it's simply a repetition of the first v'kinei et ishto to create the same framework. So what the Gemara is saying here is that this is not a generic or general machlok between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva. It's particular to these three cases, based on the psukim, or the way that you interpret the psukim here. First of all, it does raise the problem here that in general, we only apply these principles when we have no other drasha. And so he says over here, like a kal v'chomer, sometimes we'll say that the Torah writes something that it could have otherwise learned through a kal v'chomer. Why? Because that's what the Torah does. Tosafot says we only invoke that principle when we have no other drasha for those words. If we have another drasha, then we would opt for that. And he says, over here, he's not certain as to why Rabbi Shmuel would say that it's repeated simply to give you the additional detail when you have a possibility of interpreting it or giving a drasha to it. These types of principles are only used when we can't find another drasha. But here it seems that it's not the case, that it's here even in cases where we have an alternate drasha, we don't say it. The other thing that's interesting over here is that there's a fundamental machloket between the Rambam and the Ramban with regards to the aveira of lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha. The Rambam believes lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha is only when you keep it in. That the lav in the Torah is to harbor hatred. If one expresses that hatred or lets it out, then that's no longer a violation of lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha. Which the Rambam agrees it's not the right thing to do. It's wrong, but it's still not a violation of lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha. Over here, the Gemara seems to favor that interpretation of the Ramban, which is the Ramban believes that even if you express it, even if you give articulation to lo, that sin'ah that's inside, nevertheless, that is still considered to be a problem of lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha. The Gemara over here says that there's a problem or a stira, conflict, between lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha and kinei et ishto. Well, kinei et ishto is an articulation of the harbored hatred that is there. So it seemed like without this dispensation, you wouldn't be able to be kinei et ishto. Sounds more like the Ramban, which is that even the articulation of that anger, that hatred, would still be a violation of lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha. You could argue for the Rambam that if the dispensation is not given, then you would have to harbor it. And if you would have to harbor it, then you would be in violation of so the permission to go ahead and to express it now frees you of the not that if you had expressed it, you would have violated but if we did not permit you to express it, then you would have harbored it. And that harboring of it would have been the Avera. That's how you'd have to explain it according to the Rambam. All right, so now the Gemara continues, La'itama, so that you will become to me for her, Rishut, Divi Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Kiva Omer, Chuvah, that it is an obligation, my time at the Rabbi Shmuel, what's the reasoning behind Rabbi Shmuel? I did a chtiv, immoral koinim bin Aaron, v'amarta lehem, l'nefesh lo'itama be'amav, says there you may not become Tamei. It's trichalei the michtav La'itama. Anybody who you want to become Tamei for, or anybody you have the right to become Tamei for, must be listed to give you that dispensation, because the Torah gives a generic statement, do not become Tamei to Matamei. So without any dispensation, you're not going to be allowed to. So La'itama comes to tell you, yes, you can become Tamei to your sister. Rabbi Kiva, Me'ki, Im L'Sheiro. Now, you learn that from there. The puzzle says, Kim L'Sheiro Akarov Elav, to his relatives, he's allowed to become Tamei. So there's another somewhat generic statement which says that he's permitted to become Tamei for relatives. So now, La'itama Lomali. Then what do you need La'itama for? Lechova. Again, Rabbi Kiva is indicating that there's a duplication of the permission here. That duplication makes it into an obligation. And as we mentioned before, that's the way that the Rambam Paskin, then we spoke about the reasons for why it would be an obligation to become Tamei in these cases, even though she's not a mate mitzvah. That he may become Tamei for her, but he may not become Tamei to her limbs. This is something that we saw in Nazir. The way that Rashi interprets over here is that he may not become Tamei for her limbs, is her an Eber Minachai. If one of her limbs came off during her lifetime, that has a din like an Eber Minamate, the Kohen may not become Tamei to deal with that Eber Minachai. That's the way Rashi interprets it. On the other hand, the Gemara in Nazir, and this learns this drasha, at least according to some, from the word Aviv, and not from La'itama. And in addition to that, it seems to be over there that it was speaking about the case that if she is mechusar Eiver, she's missing Eivarim, or one of her Eivarim separated, the Kohen does not have permission to become Tamei for those items. The reason Rashi might have indicated here that some Eivarim Minachai is because, again, the Gemara over there darshins this din from a different word in the Pasuk. So then it would be that this drasha should be a different drasha or tell you something new. And that's what Rashi is talking about, that it's an Eiver Minachai and not an Eiver Minamate. Because Eiver Minamate, as Tosfo points out, that we learned that out from L'Aviv. Bizman Shu Shalim, below Bizman Shu Eivarim. So that would have been applicable here as well. And therefore, maybe Rashi is trying to avoid that stiram by saying that we're talking about Eiver Minachai. Where it says, Rabbi Kivim Kein Lechtob Rachman Allah, Velishtok. So then, if that's all we needed was the din of her, then it should just said la itama lomali. So what's the extra word itama? So la itama comes to teach you two dinim. One is it's an obligation to become tamei. Number two is that only for the whole her may you become tamei, not for her evarim. So then shma mina. So that's how you learn out from both of these. Rabbi Shmuel, I dichtiv tav la ketiv nami itama. Because otherwise it wouldn't sound so well. The pasuk wouldn't read so well if he just said la to her. Because it doesn't give you the context. Obviously, the pasuk speaking about becoming tamei to relatives, but la'itama sounds nicer. And so he says it's just a literary style, b'kadani tamei Rabbi Shmuel. And this literary style is like what we saw from the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Shmuel. It means Rabbi Shmuel's opinion, but it's from Tana tamei Rabbi Shmuel. The Tana Rabbi Shmuel, ko parsha shenemar v'nishneit, lo nishneit l'dabar shenitchadesh ba. Again, the repetition of phrases or words is not considered to be inappropriate. The Torah does it. To contrast or to give you the extra information. So even though it repeats the word itama over here, it's coming to teach you the information about la, about this sister that you can become tamei to her. So even though it was unnecessary maybe to say the word itama, it will say it despite the fact that that's not the chidush, or that's not adding anything to our understanding. Now, the last one is lo'olam bahem tavodu, reshut, divi Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Kiva Omer, chuva, my time of the Rabbi Shmuel. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Shmuel's position? There's an obligation to annihilate, eradicate all the Knanim when you come into Eretz Yisrael. So it's Rechnami Lechtav Lo'olam Bahem Tavodu. Then you need a dispensation to allow for an Eved Knani, the Mishrei, Echad mikol hamol shubal haknanit v'loid mimenu ben. So obviously it can't be a knani because then you're under an obligation to eliminate him. So then how do you have an eved knani if all the knanim are supposed to be wiped out? So the answer is that if you have a foreign husband that took a knanit wife and they have a child, shata rashai liknoto, that you have permission to use him as quote unquote an eved knani, even though he's not really a knani, because if he was really a knani, then you would have to eliminate him. So the fact that he's born into a, quoted, a mixed marriage of a non-Knani to a Knanit, that allows you then to take him as an Eved Knani. But that is the dispensation. Otherwise, you would not have such a dispensation. Tanya, minayin lechad min umot, shebala Knanit. How do we know that a foreigner that has a relationship or is married to a Knanit, v'olid mimenu ben, and they have a child, shata rashad liknoto be'eved, that you're allowed to then purchase him as a slave, Talmud Omar, v'gam b'bnei atoshavim hagarim imachem mehem tiknu. Also from those that sojourn amongst you, from them you are allowed to purchase. So the way that Rashi learns it over here, the word toshav always means someone who came from a foreign place. So mibnei atoshavim over here means that the individual came from a foreign location to be by his wife, and that they're living here, those children that come from them, there you're allowed to subjugate them. Yochol af knani shubala chat min umot. You would think the other way around. What happens if the husband is a knani and the wife is a foreigner? V'olim mimenu ben and they have a child. Shata rashad liknoto be'eved. You would think maybe there you could also buy him as an eved. Talmud Omar asher hulidu ba'artzechem. Those that are born in your land. Mina noladim ba'artzechem v'lo mina garim ba'artzechem. It's those that are born in your land, not those that are living in your land. Here, the husband is a Knani, the wife is a foreigner. And again, with the premise that the husband moves to where the wife is, so then the Knani that lives here now is only temporarily dwelling here, or is only here part-time because his real home is with his wife somewhere else. So, amina noladim ba'artzechem, that is someone who is born in this land, but not someone who is just a visitor or a stranger in this land because they really belong somewhere else, because the husband follows the wife. That seems to be the way that Rashi interprets this. Tosafot over here says something very important. It says, from here, we come to the conclusion that when it comes to non-Jews, there's also patrilineal descent. And that's not just a Jewish phenomenon, but it's also a non-Jewish phenomenon. And that you see here, that the father is the determining factor. If the father's a Knani, the child is deemed to be a Knani. The father's a foreigner, then the child is also a foreigner, and that's what makes the difference here. There is an alternate explanation, which seems more likely, because we know from the stories of Tanakh, that unlike today, where the husband moves to the wife, in that day the wife moved to where the husband was. And therefore the interpretation would be just the opposite, which is that, in the first instance when it says, "V'gam mibnei atoshavim agarim imachem mehem tiknu," he's a toshav now because he's only a temporary resident, because in the end, he's going to move back to his own home, and that's where they're going to go. So b'nei ha-toshavim must be those that are coming from the foreign nations and having children with the women here, because they're only here temporarily, they're going back to their homes. And the other way around, asher holidu b'artzechem min holidim b'artzechem elo min ha-garim b'artzechem. Then if he's a Knani, then he's going to live in the land. That's not what we want. We want those that are born in the land. Those that are born in the land are from those foreign husbands that are here only temporarily. They're going back home. So if they're born in the land, that's a good, because that's a foreign husband. If they live in the land, that means that the husband is a Knani, and that wouldn't work. So that's an opposite way to interpret it than Rashi, which is that husband is the determining factor as to where they live, and that then gives the status to their sojourn inside of Canaan. Rabbi Akiva. Why does Rabbi Akiva think it's a chuvah here? Because it says, Mi mehem tiknu. From amongst them you will purchase it, nafka. Lo olam bahem tavodu lomali. Then it says now you must subjugate them, or you will always subjugate them. L'chova. So you have one dispensation, which is mehem tiknu. And then the second statement, which is that you will subjugate them, is that makes it into an obligation, because you have a repetition of that instruction. Rabbi Shmuel, behem velo be'achechem. That would you, what does he learn out of the word behem? To teach you that you may subjugate the Knani, you may not subjugate another fellow Jew. Rabbi Akiva, b'achechem, miseifa dekra nafka. B'achechem, he learns out of the latter part of the pasuk. Because it says there, Ubachechem b'nei Yisrael ish be'achiv lo tirdeu bo b'forech. So the pasuk explicitly says that, that you may not treat your fellow Jew or work him hard like you would a slave. So it's explicit in the pasuk. I don't need that behem to teach me the miyut. Very small. I did ichtiv ubachechem. Since I already wrote ubachechem ish b'nei Yisrael ish be'achiv lo tirdeu bo b'forech, tiv nami behem. It teaches you also the word behem. So the behem is not the limud itself, but the achechem may be the limud, but behem comes as part of that package. The Tanya, the Bei Rabbi Shmuel, like what we had in Tana the Bei Rabbi Shmuel, like in the other times, the Tana Rabbi Shmuel, Kupashash Ne'emar v'nishneit, v'nishneit el b'shvil d'var sh'nitchadesh ba. So the repetition over here is, again, a literary style. It's not coming to give you any information, and therefore you can't draw any significance from the word behem. But that means now, according to Rashi, and the Girsa that we have in our Gemara is according to Rashi, the Gemara now rejects the limud of Bahem, and says, Eino Chanami, the limud is out of Achechem, and the word Bahem is unnecessary, because of the literary style, not because of a limud. Rabbi Shmuel originally says, Olam Bahem Tavoldu, that the Bahem is Bahem Velo Achechem. That was the original thought. Gemara says, no, in the end, Rabbi Kiva is right, that you learn that out of Me'achechem. But why does it have the word then, Bahem, over there? Because it's teaching you the same information twice, even though it's unnecessary, because, again, that is the style of the Torah. There is an alternate girsa that maintained the fact that the drasha comes out of Lo'olam Bahem Tavodu, that said, Ketiv Nami Bachichem, that Bahem was the actual limud, that was the drasha. The Gemara maintains the fact that Mehem Tiknu is the drasha from which you learn out that you can't subjugate a Jew. And that the extraneous that's there for the literary style is ubeachechem bnei Yisrael yishvachiv lo diterbo b'farech. That's the extraneous piece. That's the extra piece over there. Amar Rav Chista, zanota bebeita, znot in the house, ki karya l'shumshuma, is like a worm to a shumshum or a sesame plant, which means that it eats out the core. It kills it by eating out the heart or going inside, leaving the shell and eating that which is inside of it. So znot has the same impact on the household. It causes it to rot from the inside. We're going through Rashi's interpretation of what the karya and the shumshum over here. There are some other interpretations. The Tosfot Shas explains that the karya means the heat that kills the shumshuma, which is the tolat. It's like heat that causes the worm to die. So too, this type of behavior causes a breakdown in the household. But both the Aruch and Rashi explain it this way. Anger, kas, in the house is similar, that it causes internal rotting, and that it is like the karya l'shumshuma. Both of them are true by the wife. But with the man, it has no impact. So the way Rashi learns it is that if the woman is involved in znut, or the woman gets angry, then that is problematic for the household. Because the woman is the akeret habayit. She is the one who runs the house. If she's preoccupied with znut, or she's a person who easily gets angered, then she's going to be the person, in a sense, that causes the household to fall apart. Because she's going to neglect her role as the akeret habayit, and that's going to cause the house to implode because of the rot that's coming from the inside. That's the way that Rashi interprets it, that it has to do with the itata and not the man, as well as the fact that she is going to spend all of her husband's money in trying to win the favor of her suitor or the extramarital affair that she's having. And so through that, she's going to destroy the household, and that's why it's a focus on the itata. But that would say that znut by the man, or kas by the man, doesn't have that problem, because he's not the akeret habayit, which is not so simple and not so easy to say. So others explain that idivitata is when, in the first case of znut, it's with the wife herself that is mizana, but in the case of the kas, it's the husband's anger towards the wife. And therefore the itata over here is not that she is the kasanit, rather, she is the object of the kas of the husband, which causes the woman to leave, or causes maybe the woman to perform znut because of the way that he treats her and the way that he speaks to her. And so therefore, there would make the husband the problematic side when there is kas. And the truth is that it's probably both, which is that both when the husband and the wife act in this way, there are problems or that causes issues within the household. V'amarav chista b'tchila, kodem shechatu Yisrael, hayta shechina shoreh im kol echad v'echad. For Bnei Yisrael sinned, then the Shechina used to reside with each individual. Shneamar, okay. Ki Hashem elokecha mitalech b'kerev machanecha. Because it says that Hashem will accompany your camp. Kevin shechatu, after they sinned, nistalka Shechina mehem, the presence of Hashem left. Shneamar, because over there, it says, v'lo yireh b'cha yevat davar v'shav me'acharecha. That Hashem should not see anything inappropriate, because if he does see something inappropriate, he will leave. The pashtut of the psukim, what it's speaking about over there, is when you're going out to war, and the encampment includes the Aron and the Shekhinah's present, then you have to create a bathrooms outside of the machaneh, because it would be inappropriate to have a bathroom inside the machaneh where the Shekhinah is present. That's what it says in the pashtut of psukim over there. The Gemara is interpreting it to mean that the presence of the Shekhinah is dependent on the behavior of the individual. If everything's okay, if things are good, then the Shekhinah's there. When things are bad, the Shekhinah leaves because of Ervat Davar. Now, it's not clear here in what context this is being said or what's the sin that we're speaking about here. Likely, it connects to the previous Gemara. And the previous Gemara spoke about the anger and the znut in the household, that's problematic. On that statement, Rav Chisda says, in a normal circumstance, the Shekhinah is present in the house. And we'll see that later on in the Gemara, that Ish v'Isha, when they're unified and there's Shalom b'neihem, the Shekhinah is Shuraya in the house. And when there's discord and there's anger and there's Znut, Ervat Davar, that it comes up between them, that causes a separation of the husband and wife, and the Shekhinah can no longer be present when the Ish and the Isha are no longer together, as the Gemara says, that's Ish. It's like a fire that consumes the household. And so therefore, this is a continuation of that previous statement, which is that when the leaders of the house, the husband and the wife, are acting inappropriately, then it affects the house, because now the Shekhinah will no longer reside amongst Klal Yisrael. That's one way to learn it. The other way is to suggest that it's a more generic statement about Klal Yisrael. We mentioned this yesterday. With regards to the mitzvah of Sotah and the nes of Sotah, it only takes place when Bnei Yisrael act in a manner that's sanua, and they rid themselves of pritzut, then the Shekhinah is shoreh b'neihem. And then the nisim like this happened. But in a case where Rabu portzim, that pitzut became unabashed and it's full, society is full of it, then the nes of sotah no longer works, or that's a sign of the fact that the Shekhinah is no longer present amongst Klal Yisrael. And so therefore this ervat davar could be talking about more generically Klal Yisrael, that when they uphold the standards of tzniut and proper behavior, then the Shekhinah is amongst them. When they don't, then the Shekhinah leaves them, and they would not be zocheh to this mitzvah of sotah. Or you could say it in the generic form that when a person acts appropriately, then he is subject to hashkacha pratit, or zocheh to hashkacha pratit. On the other hand, when he does bad or evil, he chases away the Shekhinah, and then he's left up to mikreh, and he no longer has that providence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu over his life. Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yonatan. Kol oseh mitzvah achat v'olam hazeh. Anybody that does a mitzvah in this world, mikadmato v'olechet lefanav de'olam haba. It precedes him when he goes to olam haba. Shneamar, v'alach lefanecha tzidkecha. Because it says your righteousness will walk before you. So as if there's like a trumpet or an announcer coming before you. Anybody who violates an avera in this world, milafato, it hugs him or sticks to him, and stays with him for the Yom Adin. Shneamar, yilafto archot darkam, yalu betou viyovedu, so that it will accompany him through his way. Viyalo betou will go up into the nothingness, viyovedu, and that it will cause its loss. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Shura bo kekelef. It sticks to him like a dog, Shneamar. Velo shama leo lishkav etzla liotima. This is by Eshet Potifar, where she's trying to seduce Yosef. And she's trying to convince him to lishkav etzla, to lay with her, or liotima, to be together with her. Lishachevi etzla b'olam hazeh, to lay with her in this world, v'liotima l'olam haba, which would precipitate that he'd be together with her in the Olam Haba, because the Avero then would stick to him the way that a dog sticks to its owner or follows around its owner. So too over here, the sin sticks to the individual. The Marshal points out that the Mamar Chazal, that anytime a person does a mitzvah, he creates praklik techat, he gets a defense attorney, creates a malach. Anytime a person does an avera, they create a kategor, a prosecutor, or a bad malach. So this is what it's speaking about. The person who has done mitzvot and the good malachim are the ones that are coming before him. He has an announcement already that he's coming and what he's done right. On the other hand, when it comes to the sins, Marshal points out, nobody wants those to go in front of them. And therefore, malach avato, against his will, it sticks with him because he doesn't want it in front of him. He doesn't want it there. But despite the fact that he doesn't want it there, it's going to stick to him. It's going to be an indictment of that which he did wrong. And that's what's being described over here, the difference between why it walks in front of him when it's good and it sticks to him when it is bad. It's not otom. We have a mission over there. Sheyah b'din. It should be a kal v'chomer. Uma edut arishona she'eno sota isur olam. That edut does not permanently restrict her to her husband. Eina mitkayemet v'pachot mishnayim. It can only take place with two. Edut achrona, the latter edut, which osarta isur olam, will permanently restrict her from going back to her husband. Einu din shelo titkayem v'pachot mishnayim. Certainly should not be less than two. Tamalomar v'ed ein ba. Kol sheyesh ba. That anything that is there is sufficient ground to restrict her and her husband. What we're speaking about here is going back to yesterday's daf, that by eid tumah we only require a single eid. One eid is sufficient to make her asur to her husband permanently, as long as we have one eid of tumah. On the other hand, for stira, at least according to Rabbi Yoshua, you need two eidim for stira. Gemara says it's a kal v'chomer. If by stira, which is only a temporary restriction between the husband and wife until she drinks the meis sultah, over there we require two eidim, by a case where it's eidei tumah, which will permanently cause her to have to separate from her husband and you'll never be able to reconcile with her, then certainly there you should need two eidim. Talmud Lomar, the pasuk comes to teach you, ve'eidein ba, that there's a special dispensation by tumah that you only require one eid because it's eidein ba. There's no eid there. Had there been any aid whatsoever, then she wouldn't drink the mei sota. Nagmar says, well, kal v'chomer le'eduta rishona. Then the kal v'chomer should now work in reverse. Mi'ata, ma'i eduta achrona shel sota yisur olam, mitkayemet beid echad. When it comes to eidei tumah, all you need is one aid, and that's sufficient. Eduta rishona by stira, she'eno sota yisur olam, where he doesn't restrict her permanently, eno din shitzkayim eid echad, then certainly it should suffice with the eid echad, which is exactly what Rabbi Eliezer says, that it is sufficient with eid echad. Tomer lomar ki matza ba ervat davar, that he found an ervat davar, something wrong over here. Ulo alanu omer, al pi shnei edim, o pi shlosha edim yakum davar. Now we have gzeira shava, ma davar amur la'alan, al pi shnayim edim, afkan al pi Shnai Meidim, that Matzah Ba Ervat Davar, that Davar that he found in her, that Ervat Davar requires two Eidim to tell us that there was a problem here, and that problem was this Stira. Now this matches up a little bit with the Yerushalmi, who says that the Machlok between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Shua is how we interpret Ki Matzah Ba Ervat Davar, and that Gerushin is a part and parcel of this Parshia of Sota. Umar says, is that really true? Hi, Mimiki, Matzah Bar Ervat Davar Nafka. That's where we learned it out from. Mi Ba Nafka. We learned this out of the word Ba yesterday, which is Eidein Ba, Ba Zamiyut. Ba Velo Bikinoi. Ba Velo Bistira Mi Ba Yile. Then we already learned it out of the word Ba. Rabbi says, no. Achenami Kamar. That's what it means. Talmud Omar, Ba, Ba Velo Bikinoi, Ba Velo Bistira. Vituma Ba'alma Velo Kinoi, Velo Stira, Delo Mehemen, Eide Chad Minalon. In a normal case, which we discussed yesterday, in a normal case where there is an extramarital affair, but there was no warning, there was no stira, how do we know over there that one aid is not sufficient? Nemar kan ki matza ba'er vatavar, v'nemar la'alan apish ne'edim, opish lo sha'edim, yakum davar. Ma davar amur la'alan edim shnayim, afkan edim shnayim. Just like by there, the davar refers to two edim, apish shnayim edim, opish lo sha'edim. So too, the davar ba'er va also requires two edim. Tarabanan, Ezuhi Edut Rishona. When we mention here in the Braita Edut Rishona, what was that? Zo Edut Stira. That's Edut about her seclusion. Edut Acharona, what's Edut Acharona? Zo Edut Tuma. That refers to the Edut about an improper act itself. Here is explaining how we explained the Braita before, that the Rishona Acharona is trying to compare the Stira to the Tuma. Not like what you would thought, maybe Rishona meant Kinoi and Acharona meant Stira, or Rishon meant Kinoi and Acharona meant Tuma. No, it's referencing the interplay between Stira and Tuma. And there's a lot of reason to see interplay between them, as we saw yesterday, which is that Stira is considered to be Tchilat Tuma. And so there's a high correlation between them, and the Pasuk itself says, V'nistira v'nitme'ah, that there is some sort of Hekesh between the two. And therefore, we would have thought maybe to learn the Kal V'chomer, and the Pesukim say we don't learn that Kal V'chomer. Okay, we're going to stop here at the bottom of Gimel Amud Bet.